From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
If you're like me and nervous, will there be a hotel? Will there be a bed? Will there be food I can eat? I'm here to say yes. Yes, most of the places that we're going, in fact, all of them, are not going to be so different from your life that you can't enjoy it.
That's Phil Rosenthal. You may know him as the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond. After that hit sitcom ended over a decade ago, his passion for food became another focus as he continued to eat his way around Los Angeles. Now he's taking us on a journey around the world in a new Netflix show called Somebody Feed Phil. Take a listen.
Oh, what's this?
This is actually one of my favorite desserts. It's canom tuap fat.
These are sticky rice flour crepes cooked on a griddle.
They're filled with shrimp and coconut and mung beans and sesame.
This is hard to eat. Okay, do you see that? It's like pizza.
The yellow is mung bean?
Mung bean.
Mung bean.
This is kind
of what my wife calls me.
Hi.
Hello. It's good to see you again.
It's great to see you. So where was the last place you were?
Oh, goodness. Well, if we're talking about this batch of shows, I think we finished up in New Orleans. It feels like you're ending with a celebration.
Yeah.
Because there's no bigger party town in this country.
Yeah, it scares me kind of, actually.
Well, yeah, Bourbon Street. You got to get off Bourbon Street. Just like if you go to Venice, you got to get out of San Marco. And there's even another version, slightly more grown-up version of Bourbon Street, and that's called Frenchman Street. Have you been there?
No, I've never been to New Orleans.
What? You're a food lady.
I know.
What are you talking? Come on. I go with you. This is not health food.
Yeah,
I
kind of figured that out.
Their motto should be, New Orleans' motto should be, New Orleans, we're trying to kill you. But you'll die happy.
So this time, during this spate of shows, how did you determine where you were going to shoot? Was it just where you wanted to visit?
That's a big part of it. But I'm very aware that two-thirds of Americans don't have a passport. And so the message of the show is, get out there. Let's travel. There's no more mind-expanding thing we can do in life than travel. I think the world would be better if we all could experience a little bit of someone else's experience. And so I know that people are ensconced and they're a little afraid, like I was. So I'm starting with what I think are Earth's greatest hits. These are the places that I think are most accessible.
And yet you start with places like Vietnam.
Yes.
You go to Bangkok. Let's talk about Vietnam first.
Yes.
You've said that most of your ideas of the country were informed by Hollywood films.
Of course. My age, I grew up on the Vietnam War films and news. So that's what I'm expecting.
And yet the thing as a watcher,
yeah,
the thing one notices immediately are the number of children that are featured.
Very young country. Very young country. More than half the population's under 30. I think. And they don't know about the Vietnam War. They are living their lives. And you see skyscrapers and as modern as anything we have here. You see what seems like a booming economy. You see, it's nothing like what you expected.
So take me to one of your favorite experiences that you had there.
Oh, okay. They said, you're going to go out. You're going to get up at 4 a.m. You're going to go to a lake in the middle of an island, which is in the middle of the Saigon River.
And okay.
The reason you're getting up at 4 a.m. is because that's when this man and his family pick the lotus roots, and they pick snails out of the lake, and he's got a restaurant there, and there's a little pond next to it where he fishes for catfish, and you're going to go do all that with them. And I said, you lost me at 4 a.m. This is not who I am.
And as a young urban Jewish man, did you spend a lot of time fishing?
You're very sweet, but I am an old urban Jewish man, and in fact, when I was fishing, I think I said in the show, this reminds me of childhood. Not my childhood, somebody's childhood. But I enjoyed it, and I meet this man, and I meet his family, and he has two young daughters. And they have no memory of war. They don't know thank goodness, what war is, even, these kids. Isn't that how it should be?
That is how it should be.
Right.
So before you went, I would imagine that here in the L.A. area, you had experienced pho and banh mi.
Yeah.
What did you eat there that was different that you had never had before?
Oh, my goodness. How about this? How about the best pho, the best banh mi? You know, I'm always telling people, you like a food, go to the source, because it's never going to be better. You're not going to get better pasta in America than you are in Rome. Go! So that's the, you know, if you like Vietnamese food, you owe yourself a trip to Vietnam. And then, yes, I had different things. They're young people, innovators, just like here. There was a woman in the show called Nikki Tran, and she's an incredible cook. After being born in Vietnam, she was raised in Texas, I think Houston, which has a huge Vietnamese population. Then she moved back to Vietnam. Now she's doing a kind of mashup of Texas-Vietnam. I mean, that restaurant, I wish it was here.
So you went to Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
Had you traveled a lot in Israel before?
Twice before. First time I didn't enjoy it. It felt a lot like Hebrew school.
I've never been to Israel either.
What? Who am I talking to?
I'm very sheltered. I always hear about the particular energy of Tel Aviv.
Yeah, it's a very young city. I can't say it's architecturally beautiful because it was built in a hurry. And it's got a wonderful nightlife. It's got a wonderful energy and spirit. So Tel Aviv is kind of this very modern, secular, happening place. It's the party capital of the Middle East.
So let's talk about who you went with.
Michael Solomonoff is great chef from Philadelphia. He's got the James Beard Award-winning restaurant Zahav. Have you ever been there?
I've never been to Zahav, but I've interviewed him a few times, and I've cooked a lot out of his cookbooks.
Amazing guy. Has quite a history with Israel, from Israel. And for a good part of it, he was my guide for Tel Aviv and then a spot up north. Didn't go to Jerusalem on this trip. For a very good reason. I didn't want any conflict in the show. If you want conflict, Middle East conflict, go look at the news. This show is different. There's more than enough. In fact, I would say there's more good news in Israel than bad news. That I passed a bakery and the Arab gentleman, this was just by chance, the Arab gentleman behind the counter was wearing a shirt that said, Jews and Arabs refuse to be enemies. And I stopped and talked to him, and it turned out everyone there were Jews and Arabs, and they were baking the most wonderful things, and that's what kept them together.
When you go, what is the taste you want to have?
I don't think I have to tell you that Israeli cuisine is kind of taking over the world right now. It's having its moment, right? Israeli cuisine is actually an amalgam of everything in the Middle East. So Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, of course, Palestinian food. It's all kind of this wonderful mashup, hummus, sabich, shawarma, all these great things that we like, the tahina and all the dips and the pita bread and all. I love that stuff. And the lamb, right?
And it's orders of magnitude better than what we have here. You've continued the wonderful video chats that you do with your parents.
Yeah.
Which are some of them hilarious.
They're gold, I think, is the word.
Oh, my
God. In the comedy world, that's known as gold, because you just turn the camera on them, and there you go. You don't need me.
So how are they doing?
Dad's 92. Mom's 86. I hope Netflix picks up the show again, because let's go TikTok, TikTok. People come up to me. They say, oh, we like the show. We love your parents. And everybody says this to me. And I'm like, why do I bother traveling? Why don't I just sit in the kitchen with them, and that's the show?
There's this criticism that a lot of current food media is overly serious. And as somebody who has spent his career developing comedy shows and movies, you bring a more lighthearted approach. Do you think that there's a special relationship between food and humor?
Oh, isn't that great? I think yes. I think that it doesn't have to be serious. I appreciate everyone who is serious about it, especially the chefs whose food I'm eating. Thank God they're serious about it, right? But I think for most people on earth, I'm going to speak for most people on earth now, food is a break in our day. And maybe our day is filled with seriousness. Maybe our day is filled with hard work. Food is the time to have a laugh, maybe. Food is the time to let down your hair and enjoy yourself. For some people, that's all they have, is that meal break, right? That lunch to look forward to, that dinner to look forward to. And so they want to make it really good. And so what happens when food is really good. It makes you happy. So happiness, humor, I think they go together. Here's what I say. Food, in and of itself, food is the great connector. But laughs are the cement.
Oh, I love that. Well, thank you so much, Phil.
Oh, we're finished. It goes so fast with you.
It's so fast.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. That's Phil Rosenthal. Somebody Feed Phil is now streaming on Netflix. Coming up, I'm joined by Andrea Nguyen, an authority on Vietnamese food. We're talking about the reputation of MSG and whether it's earned or not. I think you'll be surprised. Don't go anywhere.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Several weeks ago, I catered a wedding. One guest kept asking the waiters if the food had MSG. It was Italian food, so kind of a weird question. But some other cuisines embrace monosodium glutamate because it simply makes things taste better. One of my favorite authors and cooking teachers is Andrea Nguyen. She recently wrote a post on her Viet World Kitchen blog debunking some of the myths surrounding MSG and its use in pho, the Vietnamese noodle soup.
It is a glutamic acid that has a sodium molecule attached to it. And glutamic acid is an amino acid that we have in our body naturally. We need it to function. From an early age on, from the time we're born practically, we naturally seek out glutamic acid. It's, you know, this naturally occurring thing, but the Japanese found a way to make it synthetically. And the thing is that the synthetic stuff versus the glutamates that would be found in, say, Parmesan cheese or seaweed like kombu, even a, you know, really ripe tomato, the naturally occurring glutamic acids are very similar, if not the same, as MSG.
And then doing research, I discovered that Romans, of course, who used garum in fish sauce, which has naturally occurring free glutamates, they used it to reduce the use of expensive salt. So maybe it all does come back to Italian food.
It really does. And salty things and savory things are like a good thing. We've demonized salt so much. And I oftentimes get these questions of like, oh my gosh, how do I reduce the salt content of pho? And I said, well, you can, you know, eat less broth, or maybe you can even try MSG because it's super salty. It's saltier than regular salt. And I love the fact that you pointed out that it's a type of seasoning salt, because that's how people should use it if they're going to, you know, start tinkering with it in their kitchens.
So what is its flavor? Does it have a flavor?
It does. And for years, and I remember I attended a day-long umami confab in San Francisco, and there is a Japanese umami group, an advocacy group that organizes fancy thing. And they said, well, MSG doesn't have a flavor. It just kind of binds to whatever and makes that food taste better. And I've grown up with MSG since I was young. My mom used it in her Vietnamese cooking, and I had it at Chinese restaurants and other Asian restaurants, and it has a flavor. And when you have too much MSG in food, the food kind of all tastes the same, and it's a savory sweetness. In Vietnamese, we call MSG bột ngọt, or that literally translates to sweet powder. So it just has that kind of sweet saltiness that is just, good.
When did MSG become a luxury item in Vietnam?
During the Vietnam War, in particular in northern Vietnam, where they didn't have access to, you know, oftentimes rice. And, you know, MSG was used to make pho. And without it, some Vietnamese people say that Vietnamese pho noodle soup is incomplete without it. The MSG in there to give it a particular flavor profile. So during the wartime years, it was a luxury. And I have this novel that I love, and it is a pho-centric novel. And they talk about this woman collecting MSG crystals for almost like a bartering system for services that she did for others during the wartime years.
What I found so fascinating about your essay was how it made you take a look at this dish, pho, that is so emblematic to the culture, and also to your mom and how she cooked.
Yeah, you know, we cook the same in many regards in terms of, you know, taking a look at techniques and using quality ingredients. But then at the end of the line, she always, you know, adds a little MSG to her pho broth before serving it. That's how she finishes it. And I don't do that because I am a, you know, 1.5 generation cook. And I say, well, my audience in the English-speaking cookbook reading world, they're not going to use MSG. You know, I don't really use it that much. I have it in my cupboard. But, you know, I wanted to give her respect because that is what she has been used to. So to demonize people for, you know, employing an ingredient that is part of their craft, that's part of what their culture is all about, that's part of the flavor that they want to build, what's the point in that? You know, I think that people who go around attacking others for their use of MSG, and particularly oftentimes they're cooks of color, Asian cooks, it's really kind of unfair because, you know what, if that is what makes that flavor profile complete, then by all means, you know, let that person do it. If they're using it as a crutch, you're going to know it right away because the food's just going to be monochromatic. And that's what I think people need to understand about MSG is that if you've got good ingredients to begin with, you can get this extra thrill by using a touch of MSG and it just kind of sends a dish over the top or takes you into a different taste. And that's the fun of it. That's, you know, where you're creating a new flavor for yourself.
So what do we say to the people who are going to write us and say, what about Chinese restaurant syndrome? I go out to an Asian restaurant and I eat, you know, plates full of dumplings or stir fries, whatever. And on my way home, I end up with a crushing headache or I feel really bloated or my eyes swell up.
I just think you may have eaten like too much salt and sugar and a touch of MSG. You know, I mean, I used to have that issue when we lived in West LA. And so we go downtown to Chinatown and have dim sum on the weekends. And then we'd be driving home, you know, on a Saturday or Sunday. And inevitably, I don't know, around Robertson, I guess, we would start getting into a fight. And my husband and I were like, God, what is wrong with us? Oh, it must be that damn MSG. And I realized later on, after I wrote a book about making dumplings, that there is a lot of layers of different kinds of sodium, and you add in there in the sugar, and then if there's a touch of MSG too, you're just overloading your body, and you're just, you know, you're drinking more water too. So of course you're going to feel bloated, but it doesn't mean that it's a bad thing, because the great thing about MSG is that it goes into your body and it also leaves.
And I have to say, if you're a migraine sufferer who's been told to avoid fermented foods like wine or parmesan, you probably should be avoiding MSG.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we each have different systems, and some people react, you know, on a very highly sensitive level to something like MSG, and others don't. But I think that in the main, a lot of people have overreacted to the potential presence of MSG or the presence of MSG to the point where they may not be experiencing food in a really fabulous way. You know, I mean, they're almost like depriving themselves. You don't have to like be, you know, spooning MSG into your food. But if you invite a little bit into your life, maybe you're going to, you know, have like a different food experience. On a last note, there was a woman who wrote on my blog that she likes to eat Chinese food at takeout places, but she doesn't always have the money for it. So she uses a little MSG when she makes Chinese food to get at the flavor that she's used to getting.
Andrea Nguyen is the author of several cookbooks, most recently, The Pho Cookbook. Find her essay on MSG on the Good Food blog. That's blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Now for a visit with our friend Jonathan Gold, who's here with a pair of restaurant recommendations. I'm looking forward to wherever you're taking us today.
Even though we're going to Cerritos?
Yeah, why not?
Sure, Cerritos is cheerful, a lot of Filipino food, lots of places to buy cars. Indian restaurants aren't bad, and today we're going to a Mexican restaurant, or what the chef owner Thomas Ortega calls pocho cuisine.
And pocho cuisine means?
It means Mexican-American, the kind of Mexican food that you would get if you were growing up in Los Angeles.
My stomach just got ready to receive a huge amount of food. So what are you feeding us mentally?
It's in a pretty nondescript shopping center. There's usually a line on weekends, sometimes a really long line on weekends.
What is this place called?
It's called Amor y Tacos.
Oh, Love and Tacos.
You can get the usual stuff there, but what Ortega's idea is to sort of slam like Chicano culture and Mexican culture together and almost see what comes out. It's almost like splitting the atom, right?
Yeah. So what does come out?
If you see something on a menu called Doritos Chilaquiles.
Oh, yum.
So, you know, chilaquiles, which is basically tortillas like fried and then sauteed with sauce and stuff. Here they do it with Doritos. And the Doritos, of course, completely dissolve into a paste with, you know, red salsa and the cream and whatever. And they have their own fried tortillas around the side, so there's a real crunch to it. But you're eating this, and you get that real sort of high toasted corn stink that you get from Doritos and Fritos. I'm not that into it as a thing in itself, but as part of something, it's kind of delicious.
I'm sure.
He does a taco that's a flour tortilla stuffed with roast duck, hoisin sauce, pickles, scallions. In other words, he's making Peking duck. He does pork belly that he glazes with Coca-Cola. And one of his tacos that I completely love, I guess this isn't really a play in anything, but he uses queso quemado, which is to say like cheese that's been put on a griddle until it turns brown and chewy and like a little bit crisp. And then you put that into a freshly made tortilla with salsa and stuff. And it's just so good. As you go right inside the front door, as you walk in, there's a station with a comal and a woman making tortillas.
Both flour and corn?
Both flour and corn. Mostly
That's
corn.
Worth the drive to Cerritos right there.
It's something I wish like every Mexican restaurant did.
Does Ortega also have another restaurant?
He has another restaurant called Playa Amor in the Long Beach Marina, very close to places with boats, actually right in between a BevMo and a Pilates studio.
I love L.A.
It's double height. It's glassed in. It gets a very sort of brunchy crowd, if you know what I mean.
Is the food more refined?
The food is pretty close to the same, though they have some fancier dishes on the menu. Like they do a version of pescado zarandeado, that Colima butterfly grilled fish that's such a hit in Los Angeles. They do a version of lobster in the style of Puerto Nuevo. And it's good. There's nothing better than like a split and griddle lobster served with melted butter tortillas, salsa. That's your afternoon settled, you know?
Yeah, that's it right there.
They have wonderful micheladas, and they also have a mezcal program. You know me. I like both places, but like one of the places is where I would take my mother-in-law, and the other is where I would like sort of go myself and probably have two more mezcals than I should.
And for dessert, are we eating churros and chocolate?
They have really good churros, but if I was going to, like, name a dessert you should have, you should probably get an order of the mole tots, which is the
mole tots?
Yeah. If they're sort of like nachos made with mole, although at the fancy restaurant, they call it mole tot poutine.
It doesn't seem like a dessert, though.
Dessert is all in your mind, Evan. It's all in your mind.
That's true. Wow, that sounds great. You know what gets me going.
After 20-odd years, I'm glad I could still do it for you.
That's Jonathan Gold on Playa Amor in Long Beach and Amor y Tacos in Cerritos. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Text the words good food to 69866, and you will get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. In a moment, a chef who left one of the most prestigious restaurants in the world to make school lunches. That's when the show continues. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. In 2015, Chef Dan Giusti decided to leave Michelin-starred restaurant Noma and even his mentor, Rene Redzepi, behind. It was for a surprising new adventure. Dan moved back to the U.S. to serve $3 meals to public school students. In fact, he formed a company, Brigade, that finds chefs to lead a single school kitchen with the goal of transforming the way kids eat. Chef Dan Giusti joins us from WNPR in Connecticut. I guess my first thing would be, what are some hits from your latest menu?
Yeah, that's a good question, that's for sure. One of the biggest changes we made was, of course, taking off all the processed chicken foods, so chicken nuggets and chicken patties and all these things, and replacing them with bone-in, skin-on chicken thighs that are just roasted chicken. So one of our most popular meals, I should say, is barbecue chicken with fresh-made cornbread that's served warm and potato salad. So super simple, but all made from scratch, and definitely, you know, one of these kind of like all-American classic meals.
Let's back up a bit. When you were looking for school to get started, you had some requirements. What was the search like?
You know, there's a few things. Of course, there's the physical size of the school district itself. I know I wanted to start in an area that was not too big, but at the same time was more than one school. So a smaller school district, like six schools where we started in New London. Definitely a school district that was populated by more low-income families. Definitely the work we're doing is to help those who really need it most. From a physical standpoint, definitely looking for schools that already have some kind of kitchen infrastructure. As most people probably know, a lot of the kitchens across the country and schools aren't really well equipped. Definitely at this point in the business, looking for schools that have something already. I think down the line, we will be able to tackle more school districts that don't have too much equipment. And then finally, probably the most important thing is just general buy-in from the people that make the decisions within a school district.
When a lot of us think of public school lunches, we think about prepackaged processed food. You peel off the cellophane, kind of like an airplane meal.
That's right.
Is that what you ate at school growing up?
It's funny, you know, for me, food has always been a huge, important part of my life. I come from a big Italian family, but I don't even really remember eating school lunch, period. I think it's a funny thing because, of course, that question's been asked to me before, but I think that in itself really indicates what school lunch was for me. It really wasn't lunch. It was just a break period because the food was just, it didn't matter because what we were being served, the experience as a whole, I think, really didn't warrant any kind of real attention or thought. So for me, it wasn't the reason or the motivation for me doing this. Quite frankly, I don't even remember it.
The budget for meals like that, like the airplane kind of meal, versus your budget, how different are they?
The budget's the same. So I think one thing that people would suspect by putting a chef in a school that we're kind of operating on some different terms. All the meals that we prepare fit the USDA nutritional guidelines that all schools that operate within the National School Lunch Program have to abide by, as well as the budget. So you talk about this reimbursement rate, which essentially is the amount of money the government will give a school if they serve a meal that fits those nutritional guidelines. This year, it's in the vicinity for lunch around $3.31, but that is for food, that is for labor, that's for maintenance, that's really for everything. In some cases across the country, that even is the money that the school district will ask the food service program to pay for utilities within the kitchens. So when it comes down to it, for food, we have about $1.25, and that's pretty standard across the board, across the country. I think if you were to ask most food service directors, they're targeting their lunch cost of food to be in the vicinity of $1.20 to $1.35, and we operate within that. So the one thing that I think many people don't think about is that making food from scratch is actually less expensive. So we do have more labor costs, but as far as ingredients go, it's cheaper to buy that bone-in, skin-on chicken thigh than it is to buy a chicken patty.
One of the things that intrigued me about what you're doing and why I wanted to talk to you is this idea that's at the core of Brigade, which is assigning a chef with a certain set of skills to an individual kitchen, and then that person is a full-time employee in that kitchen. Has that been done anywhere before?
There's definitely places across the country that have employed chefs, mostly in more of the, if there's 20 schools, the school district might hire a chef to kind of help develop recipes or help train. There's definitely private schools across the country, I feel, that have hired chefs full-time. As far as there being public schools that hire chefs full-time, one chef per each school, I'm not aware of districts that are doing that. Surely there could be somewhere, but not to my knowledge. Again, there are a lot of chefs involved in this space, but again, I think the differentiation is this one chef per one school as a full-time position.
And what was it that you thought this particular model could bring to the public school lunch situation that would solve some problems?
You know, chefs are trained to do various things, not just cook. They're trained to manage kitchens from a logistical standpoint. They are trained to train other people. They're trained to keep kitchens clean. They're really just the perfect people to manage food service. And it is kind of a funny thing that across the country in school kitchens, or for that matter, institutional food service kitchens, are typically not managed by chefs, which is kind of funny because, again, these are the people that are trained to do that work. So for me, it's a simple concept of taking someone who is trained exactly to do that type of work and put them into that position and allow them to kind of utilize a skill set that they already have. So they really bring a lot to the table, more than just what you would expect of a chef, but they're leaders within the schools, they're role models within their schools. I mean, my goal is that these people are just as important as teachers within a school.
Does having an individual chef, a personality within each school kitchen, help the buy-in with other existing kitchen staff? And do those staff that have been there previously, do they remain?
Probably the idea of building relationships between the chef and the staff of the kitchens or the students or the school administration, probably the most important thing we do. That's a big part of this one-to-one ratio with the chef in each school, because they're there every day and they can really develop these relationships. You know, to answer the second part of your question, when we went into New London and when we moved forward, we never displaced people. The point is that a big part of the model is taking a group of people who have been around, and some of which have not been trained too much, and really working with them and working with their skill sets and training them. So we didn't displace anyone. But of course, this is a challenge because you come into a situation where you've had a lot of really hardworking, great people who've spent a lot of time in these kitchens. I mean, we have people in our kitchens that have worked there for over 30 years. And then all of a sudden, you go from this kind of heat and serve model, which doesn't require a tremendous amount of work, to all of a sudden, all this scratch made food. So you're really increasing the workload significantly. And how do you do that in a way that doesn't disgruntle everyone? And that's really dependent on the chef's ability to kind of work with these people and make them feel good and confident about what's happening.
You were the head chef at Noma, which is no joke. It's consistently ranked in the top 10 restaurants of the world. Are there skills from having worked at such an elite kitchen that you find yourself using or relying on for Brigade?
For sure. I mean, I always say, and I'm a firm believer, that in general, cooking food for people is kind of the same across the board, whether it's at Noma, whether it's in a school, whether it's in a middle-of-the-way restaurant. I mean, it's kind of your ambition and doing as much as you can within the constraints that you have to do your best. And I think working at Noma definitely opened my eyes to what you can accomplish if you put everything you have into something. It really also encouraged me to kind of shoot for the stars as far as what I could accomplish. So for me, you know, people always ask, oh, do you miss working in a place like Noma because it was so intense and this and that? But Noma doesn't create the intensity. The people create the intensity. And there's no reason that working in a school kitchen, you can't have that same attention to detail and kind of the same motivation to put a lot of thought into what you're doing. So there's no question that working in a place like Noma prepared me to do what I'm doing now. And I try my best to kind of communicate this feeling of, I don't want to say perfection, but this idea of really putting everything you have into something to the rest of the chefs. And I think it's super important.
Were you surprised by the discerning palate of your new customers?
I guess I wasn't surprised by that, but it's definitely the biggest challenge we face. I mean, we talk about the USDA nutritional guidelines. We talk about the budget requirements. You know, we can come up with recipes that we feel very confident about as chefs that fit within those constraints. But the final test that the kids actually enjoy it, whether it's the way it tastes or the way it looks or the way you eat it, whether you pick it up or use a fork or knife to eat it, they're very critical. And when you're catering to, again, a wide variety of ages, it's a huge challenge. And, you know, making food for a 6-year-old versus making food for an 18-year-old is a very different thing. So I love it because it pushes us, but it's definitely very complicated. And in my opinion, it's clearly the hardest kind of job or group that I've ever catered to in my career.
I love that. That's Chef Dan Giusti, former head chef of NoMa. His company, Brigade, brings trained chefs into public school kitchens to reimagine school lunches and cook delicious food from scratch. Now for a visit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Market Report correspondent Laura Avery is on the scene.
I'm happy to be visiting today with our first Market Report of the year with a piesmith, Brianna Abrams, who is the owner and head pie maker at Winston Pies in Brentwood.
We are doing, citrus is in season now in the winter. We're going to be doing my Grandma Edna's lemon meringue pie.
Okay, classic.
Classic.
But there's probably hundreds of variations. Everybody's had a really bad soggy lemon meringue pie.
Ooh, weepy.
Right, weepy.
Ugh.
So tell us about yours.
Absolutely. So you're right. The classic part is where I find my challenge. And I find the people who love lemon meringue, and it's their favorite pie in the entire world, and they have to judge my lemon meringue pie because I want them to tell me that's the best lemon meringue they've ever had. That's the challenge. That's the goal. It is a tricky, tricky pie. It's pretty simple when you look at the ingredients and you think, oh, this isn't going to be too bad. But it is really tricky. And I think the most tricky part, to be honest, is where that meringue meets the curd.
Okay, those are the two parts. And then there's the soggy bottom on the crust, too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so the par baking, that is one of those things I sort of mastered a technique. You get your par baked crust technique down, the soggy crust doesn't tend to be such a problem. And how runny and loose or how firm you make that filling will affect your crust.
Okay, then what about the lemon curd? Tell us how you make that.
Yeah, so again, just a couple of very simple ingredients. And because there are only a few ingredients, you got to use really good ingredients. People will taste the difference. It really does make a difference in your final pie. So it's sugar and egg yolks. So right there, egg yolks. I like to get really dark yolks, right? You want to, if you can do it, get those really fresh eggs. You'll taste the difference for sure. Fresh lemon juice. We squeeze it and strain it. You want to get all that pulp out of there and zest it. I like a little bit of zest for a lemon boost. We've learned that people who like lemon meringue and it's their favorite, they really want that lemon flavor. They're looking for that tang in the tart. So give it to them and put the zest in there. They like that. And then you're going to need a thickener, which would be like a cornstarch. And that is the traditional lemon meringue filling and some water. And a little salt. That's it. Pretty simple.
You cook it?
Yes, yes, yes. So mix it all together, get it on the stove, and then it'll start forming into that. It'll go from a loose liquid with all that water and juice into something that is the consistency. And then knowing when to pull it off is the trick.
Do you use Meyer lemons or the tart lemons?
Right. So I've used both. And my grandmother, Edna, whose recipe I based my lemon meringue on, she's famous for it. She would use those for your traditional lemons that you see growing around here in Santa Monica and in L.A. But I like to use a Meyer sometimes. I think it gives it a little smoother edge. And Meyer lemons smell so good. And they tend to be juicier. They really give you a lot of juice. Whereas sometimes when I'll pick lemons, I don't get as much juice out of them.
So after you've cooked all those egg yolks into the custard, then you use the whites for the meringue. Then you can use that for the topping, right?
Yes, yes. You save them when you separate the yolks. Exactly. Meringue is pretty simple. It's really simple. It's some sugar and you've got your egg whites. And you just whip that up and then you mound it on top. It's really fun. I love a really tall, dramatic lemon meringue. And again, the lemon meringue folks, they're looking for that in their experience. When they cut into a slice, they want to see that divide of big white cloud meringue and some really good lemon not oozing out. They want to see it stand up on its own, but not be like Jell-O. They don't want Jell-O.
What is the best thing to drink with a slice of pie?
I like coffee. I love coffee. Okay. So we've got pie, a good cup of coffee, and if you want, we do a la mode, a scoop.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It was great meeting you.
Thank you so much. I hope we can share some pie soon.
I hope so. That was Brianna Abrams, and she is the piesmith, head baker, owner of Winston Pies, which opened up on San Vicente Boulevard in Brentwood. All pies, all the time, and so many flavors to choose from. So now I'm talking with Leti Garcia from Garcia Organic Farm in Fallbrook, and you guys are citrus growers primarily. You also have a little bit of guavas and some other things. You grow Meyer lemons. Can you tell us about the Meyer lemon season and what it is about Meyer lemons that are special and why do you grow them?
Meyer lemons season is between late November through July, August for us. But we actually start bringing Meyer lemons since like August, and we call them silver Meyer lemons. They're the same lemons, but they just have the green skin. Still very fragrant, very juicy, just not as sweet as a Meyer lemon gets. And the reason why a Meyer lemon is sweet is because it's a cross of an orange and a lemon. But it is used as a lemon, not as an orange, because it is sour.
Right. And when it's green, I think that doesn't affect the flavor so much. Isn't that just a way for the skin to kind of protect itself from the sun?
True, because we need cold weather for it to turn color. So as the weather starts getting colder and colder, it starts getting yellow and darker orange, because it will turn to a dark orange, not as bright as a orange gets, but more orange than a regular Eureka.
And are they just hanging on the tree the whole time and you just go out and pick them, and the longer they hang on the tree, does the flavor just keep getting better and better?
Yes, as the season progresses, it gets riper and riper. And since we're pretty small, we are able to go from tree to tree, not just wipe one tree out. We go to the ripest and pick that ripe tree, move on to another tree, get the ripest one.
So how many times will you pick one tree?
A good 6-7 times.
Really?
And a lot of our Meyer lemon trees are dwarfs and they produce a lot. A lot of people think that because it's a dwarf, it's not going to produce. It does produce. It just produces lower and to the sides.
So no ladders.
Yeah. That's it's way easier for the pickers.
Right. Yeah. All right. So the Meyer lemons. Now, do you also grow the Eureka lemons?
We don't grow the Eureka lemons. We grow this lemon that we call a seedless lemon. And it's just like a Eureka. Looks the same, but it is seedless. The reason that we don't grow Eurekas, according to my father-in-law, was because they're very fragrant and they attract a lot of the bugs. Since we're organic, he tried to stay away from those. But the seedless lemons are also pretty fragrant, so we just have to be more careful, I guess.
All right. Well, thank you so much. So the Meyers are good, the way to go. And I guess they go great in a lemon meringue pie, too.
Yes, they do. I had a friend that brought me a pie. And when she doesn't have key lime pie, she substitutes with the Meyer lemon.
Meyer lemons, yeah. Do you grow key limes?
Yeah, key limes and bear's lime.
Oh, nice.
And finger limes.
All right, how many varieties of citrus do you grow?
I don't know exactly, but a lot. I never counted them.
All right, Leti. Well, thank you so much. Great talking with you.
Thank you, guys.
That was Leti Garcia, and she's with Garcia Organic Farm in Fallbrook. And they're a multi-generation, third generation now. Her kids are on the farm, too. Citrus farmer. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
After the break, something different. An interview with me for a change. I'm talking about some of my favorite songs, from cello music to classic rock. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. We close out our show this week with something different. Recently, I had the chance to be interviewed on KCRW's excellent music program, The Guest DJ Project. Here on Good Food, I'm usually the one doing the interviewing, but in this segment, Eric J. Lawrence is asking me about some of the songs that shaped my life. Here it is.
Hi, I'm Eric J. Lawrence. Evan Kleinman, the much-beloved host of Good Food since 1998, knows better than just about anybody about food and its surrounding culture, making it, eating it, and selling it. She owes her expertise to her passion for all things culinary and to being a former restaurateur, an author of numerous cookbooks, and a frequent speaker on food sustainability. Oh, and she can bake a mean pie. But today, like a lazy Susan, we turn the tables on Evan and I grill her about the music that has influenced her life in and out of the kitchen. Welcome, Evan.
Hello, Eric.
Well, so what's the first track you got for us?
So for my first pick, I chose Peter and the Wolf by Prokofiev. Mm-hmm. It may seem like a very strange first pick, but I grew up in a household where music was always playing. And I was brought to concerts here in Los Angeles as a very young person. And, you know, Peter and the Wolf is one of those pieces that's meant to teach little kids about all the different parts of the orchestra. I kind of took it in a different way, though, because I made my nursery school teacher break the record in front of me because I was so terrified by the emotions that it stirred in me.
Wow. Huh. What were those emotions?
I think fear. You know, people, Disney is very different now, but when I was a little kid, Disney, and this was a very classic Disney version of Peter and the Wolf, is very scary. The wolves, whatever the evil is super evil. And so this is like the ultimate soundtrack of that. And I just remember there was this one day, I was probably 3 and a half, and my nursery school teacher put on Peter and the Wolf. And I think it was the combination of being in that brick building enclosed and the rain pounding down and starting to hear that wolf sound of the wolf coming after Peter, that I just flipped out and I just told her she had to break the record. And she said, I'll tell you what, Evan, we'll just put it aside. And I just wouldn't give in.
So she really did have to break the record?
I made her break it in front of me.
Wow. Well, here it is, a powerful piece of music from Prokofiev. It's Peter and the Wolf.
Feeling himself caught, the wolf began to jump wildly, trying to get loose.
That was Peter and the Wolf, the Alec Guinness narrated version. What's your next selection for us?
The next track is just a little bit from Bach Cello Suites Suite Number One, as played by Pablo Casals. I started taking cello lessons when I was about 7, probably due to what I had seen going to see Peter and the Wolf. I fell in love with the instrument because of its timbre, which was just like a human voice. And there's something about the Bach Cello Suites that at that time of my life, by the time I got around to starting to be able to play them, I was maybe an early teen, when you feel that your life is really chaotic. And this piece of music is really about order and melody. And I've always been very drawn to melody in music. It fed me emotionally, this music, and I would listen to it over and over and over again.
Wow, that's cool. I don't know, do you still play the cello?
No, basically once I started, this is my excuse of why I don't play the cello anymore. When I started cooking and I had my hands in water all the time, it became much more difficult to maintain the calluses necessary
right.
to be good at playing a stringed instrument.
Well, here is the Bach Cello Suite Number One, as performed by Pablo Casals. That was Pablo Casals performing the Bach Cello Suite Number One. What's the next track you have for us?
Well, of course, the next track is The Beatles.
Sure.
The Beatles, that was my first concert. When people say, who's your first concert?
Wow.
My first concert was The Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl.
Okay, that's classic.
So they were the soundtrack of my childhood, because I was 11 when they were on the Ed Sullivan Show. And picking a Beatles song is incredibly hard. But I have just vivid memories of listening for the first time to Sgt. Pepper. I think I ditched school with my boyfriend and another one of our friends, and we went to this friend's house and got properly baked. And literally for probably 6 hours, did nothing but listen to this album over and over and over again, which is, you know, it's great that we all have access to this music, but we listen to all of our music alone by ourselves within our heads and our headphones. And the social activity of sitting with really close friends and discovering a piece of music for the first time together and then exploring it by repeated playing, there's no substitute for that. So I chose A Day in the Life from Sgt. Pepper. And for me, A Day in the Life, just like Casals for me was order, A Day in the Life to me is chaos, but melodic as well. And going back and listening to the lyrics of that song, very, very in the now.
Well, here it is, timeless piece of music from the Beatles, A Day in the Life.
Woke up, fell out of bed, dragged a comb across my head. Found my way downstairs and drank a cup. And looking up, I noticed I was late. Found my coat and grabbed my hat. Made the bus in seconds flat. Found my way upstairs and had a smoke. And somebody spoke and I went into a dream.
That was the Beatles classic, A Day in the Life, as selected by our guest, Evan Klein. Well, coming up, we've got another great artist. Who you got?
Next song, Jimi Hendrix, All Along the Watchtower, because it's a twofer. It's Jimi Hendrix and Bob Dylan. What can you say? I mean, you know, I was coming of age, so that also means sexually, right? During the 60s. And I grew up in LA, and I went to concerts constantly. And I don't know how this happened, but I went to the Whiskey all the time when I was a teenager. Either they never checked ID, or they didn't care, or they had a different focus then. But I remember going to see the Jimi Hendrix Experience at the Whiskey, and so being like 15 feet away.
Wow.
But All Along the Watchtower for me is, again, just lyrically, just a song that takes you away. And also, I think, a perfect song for now. But his incredible talent of the guitar and his musicality, but then that voice of Butter, which to a teenage girl was just like swoon worthy. Yeah, he was definitely my fave.
You speak of these components that made the essence of a magisterial song like that as if they are ingredients.
I am really aware of layering. I love how there are layers in life, and certainly with music, when you have different layers of tracks coming together, each of them exploring something emotional, and then you lay on top of that lyrics, somebody is taking you on a journey. It's the best part of what music offers. What I think is fascinating about music compared to what I do is what I do is so physical and non-ethereal. It's something you make in real time and then gets consumed. Whereas music is the absolute opposite of that. It exists in these waves that, you know, we can barely see.
Well, here's that great combination, Jimi Hendrix covering Bob Dylan with All Along the Watchtower.
All along the watchtower, princess kept a view. While all the women came and went, barefoot servants too.
That was Jimi Hendrix with All Along the Watchtower. So what's the final track you've got for us?
Okay, the next one is kind of a wild card, but in my life, not really. And it's Mina, who was the classic Italian singer of the 60s and 70s, which was the time that I was going to Italy for the first time. So when I was exploring Italy when I was 17, 18, 19 years old, Mina was the soundtrack to that experience. Just in my mind, it's being on a train and having my Walkman and listening to her sing Parole, Parole, and just becoming besotted with the culture, with the way the air felt and the way the countryside looked and, of course, the way the food tasted.
Was that around the time that you kind of first sort of taking serious the culinary experience as being something that you might venture into as a profession?
Well, I started cooking for money when I was in high school, when I would sell cookies to stoners. They were not stoned cookies. They were just regular cookies, but there was an appreciative audience at my high school at the time. And that's actually how I financed my first trip to Europe.
Wow, that's a lot of cookies.
Yeah, a lot of demand. And so I was already sort of like some young people would finance their first foray into earning money by being a server. For me, it was being a cook. So I worked for caterers. And so I already kind of knew that I loved cooking, but Italy definitely was where I became really aware of my hunger to learn about cooking in a cultural way, not just what's on the plate, but the story behind it.
Well, here is Mina in duet with the song Parole, Parole.
No, non dire nulla, c'è la notte che parla.
Cosa sei?
La romantica notte.
Non cambi mai, non cambi mai, non cambi mai.
Tu sei il mio sogno proibito.
Proprio mai.
È vero, speranza.
Nessuno più ti può fermare. Chiamami passione, dai, hai visto mai.
That was Mina with Parole, Parole. Well, Evan, we really appreciate you taking some time to share some of your music favorites with us.
Thank you, Eric.
For a complete track listing and to find these songs online, go to kcrw.com/guestdjproject and subscribe to the podcast through iTunes.
Normalmente mi tengo una sveglia mentre io voglio dormire, sognare l'uomo che a volte c'è in te quando c'è.
So many thanks to Eric J. Lawrence and the Guest DJ Project for having me on their show. That's it for this week's show. One more thing before we go. In case you hadn't heard, LA's favorite restaurant week, Dine LA, is in full force. Dine LA runs through January 26th, and you can find some crazy affordable lunch and dinner deals at some of the city's best restaurants. I'm sharing my recommendations on the KCRW blog. Visit blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any part of this week's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, or find us on Apple Podcasts. Many thanks to the Good Food team. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I will be back next week with more Good Food.